From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and yes, welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Well, here's what's happening. Well, they're still talking about that unbelievable story in Austin, Texas. That Texas pilot who flew his small plane into a tax office building hid his grudge against the government from many of his friends, but he had just begun to worry his family in the weeks leading up to the suicide mission. The software engineer, Joseph Stack, was known in Austin, Texas, as just a typical easygoing guy who enjoyed playing in a honky-tonk band and didn't talk much about politics. 53 years old, Stack played bass in the Billy Ellie Band, and he and his wife, a pianist in the graduate music program at the University of Texas, a great curriculum there, by the way, would put on concerts for their friends at their sprawling home. Stack apparently posted a rambling suicide note on his website, ranting against the Internal Revenue Service before he set his house on fire, drove to a nearby airport, took off in his private plane, flew it straight into the seven-story building. The plane crashed through the building's black glass at the second floor at 9:56 a.m., causing a tremendous fireball. Two bodies were recovered from the building, one believed to be him, the other a federal employee who was missing after the attack. 13 people were injured, two critically. Major League Baseball has a new message for players and employees this spring training. Keep the guns, long knives, and explosives out of the clubhouse. Signs have been placed in spring training locker rooms stating individuals are prohibited from possessing deadly weapons while performing any services for MLB, Major League Baseball. The rules apply to employees of the commissioner's office and other central baseball businesses and to teams, including players. Baseball officials said the Major League Baseball developed the rules last year after a former NFL star accidentally shot himself, which led to a two-year prison sentence for him. Actor-director Sean Penn has been charged with battery and vandalism charges stemming from an altercation with a photographer in Brentwood last fall. Penn will be arraigned March 22nd on two misdemeanor charges. Penn kicked a photographer in October. The photographer's camera also was damaged. The incident was captured on a video posted by the celebrity website TMZ.com, in which Penn is seen kicking at the photographer and repeatedly telling him, "Get out, get out." If convicted, Penn could face up to 18 months in jail. Some of these photographers, though, are everywhere, aren't they? You come out of dinner and there they are. Boeing has sent layoff notices to more than 1,000 people, most of them technology workers in the state of Washington and California, a few in Missouri. The notices mean that the workers are at risk of being laid off April 23rd. The planned layoffs are part of a 10,000 job cuts program by Boeing, originally targeted in 2009. Late last year, it said it would meet and then exceed the goal of 10,000 job cuts during 2010. Not good news. And for the first time in almost 3 years, the number of homeowners falling behind on their loans appears to be declining. The drop means the number of people losing their homes may start to fall, because millions of people are already in foreclosure. Deeply discounted houses will put pressure on home prices for years. Catherine Austin Fitz, Solari.com, is on the line with us. Catherine, this is a confusing story because it doesn't feel like the housing market is getting any better.
No, it certainly doesn't, George. And of course, it's very quirky because different places are very different. And we see a lot of the foreclosure, the high foreclosure rates concentrated in a small number of states. But I think if you look at the actual statistics, the drop that is being pointed to is much too small to be statistically significant. And, you know, we're watching a big push-pull in the housing market because the administration is taking lots of different steps to support the market. At the same time, the Fed is taking a series of steps which are going to, you know, is going to make mortgage finance tighter or more expensive this year. So you've got the administration pushing, but you've got the Fed pulling money out. So I just think it's too early. We're going to have to wait and see. You know, spring is the time usually when the housing market picks up.
Right.
So I would say that that March to June is going to be the real test of which way we're going to go in 2010.
And it sounds like they're grasping at straws, trying to make a little news bigger than it really is.
Well, you know, it's the nature of entrepreneurs to, you know, you want to promote the economy because you want to talk the economy in a good direction. You don't want to trash it. At the same time, real estate doesn't have much value if the people in it don't have jobs.
Absolutely. Hey, by the way, I enjoyed the radio interview you did with me on your radio show.
It is such a pleasure, George, always. So, but it was great to ask you questions and to say, and Wes from the Rockies.
Take care, Catherine.
Thanks, George.
Catherine Austin Fitz. The Large Hadron Collider will be switched on again next week, according to the laboratory that operates it. The particle accelerator was shut down for Christmas during that period, shortly after setting the record for the highest particle energies ever attained. Over the coming months, scientists aim to smash that record again as the experiments aim for energies of some 7 trillion electron volts. Can you believe that? After firing its thrusters in 2 separate maneuvers, the space shuttle Endeavour has left the orbital neighborhood of the International Space Station and has begun the 2-day trip back to Earth. The shuttle is due to land in Florida Sunday night at 10:16 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, and our science advisor, monitors these stories for us. How many more shuttle missions left, Richard, before it's all done?
We only have 4 more.
Oh. And then what do we do?
Well, that's up to Obama and the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Congress, and everybody, I think, is reading the Obama budget wrong. The only place where we have bipartisanship in any government operation now are on the space committees in Congress. What I think the president is doing is only providing information on half of what he would like to do with NASA, and he is basically trying to get the Republicans to come up with the other half, which includes a much cheaper way to go back to the moon and on to Mars. And Richard Shelby, who is the key leading Republican on the space committees from Alabama, appears to be willing to meet him halfway. And you're going to see this played out in these committees beginning on the 24th of this month, when Senator Nelson from Florida, who's a Democrat, is going to be holding hearings on Obama's NASA proposals. But this is not over by a long shot. And what's going to come out the other end, with a little help from our audience, the Coast family, I think is going to be something very interesting indeed.
Your timing, by the way, is incredible. I just opened up a package a couple days ago, and there was the startling new NASA, the Kennedy-Obama connection to 2012, and you're all over it.
Oh, you've got your Christmas present, finally.
Finally, I know it.
Well, I hope you take some time this weekend and go look at it, because it's 2 hours and 20 minutes of painstaking work that's taken me about 25 years to put together, which actually provides a rationale for why we have NASA at all. It goes back to Eisenhower, Kennedy, 2012 is in there, as well as a very important new set of developments on who killed John Kennedy. And I guarantee you there are going to be a lot of surprises in this DVD, and I'm hoping you'll give everybody a report after you look at it.
I will do that. I'll be taking notes. Thanks, Richard. Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. A secondhand shoe shop owner stole more than 1,200 pairs of designer shoes by posing as a mourner in a South Korean area. He would go to funeral homes. Listen to what he did. His haul, by the way, has been put on display by police in Seoul in hopes of reuniting as many as all these, I guess, if there's 1,200 pairs of shoes, you're talking about 1,200 people with their rightful owners. This 59-year-old thief, known only as Mr. Park by police, had walked off with his stash from funeral homes and hospitals across the capital of South Korea. His victims were the mourners who had slipped off their shoes out of respect, according to national tradition. So then he came by and scooped them up and took off. Amazing.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
And in a moment, you're going to cross over into the Twilight Zone, the American television anthology, of course, created by Rod Serling. Each episode, 156 in the original series, is a mixture of self-contained fantasy, science fiction, suspense, horror, and often including the macabre or the unexpected twist. Up next, Mark Zakrie joins us as we talk about The Twilight Zone Companion next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Mark Zakrie has more than 100 dramatic television credits to his name, including episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Twilight Zone, and Sliders. Mark has also served on staff on series including Lazarus Man, Beyond Reality, Friday the 13th, the series. And he has written, of course, a number of books, including The Twilight Zone Companion. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. You're one of our favorites, Mark. How are you?
I'm great, George, and it's terrific to be with you tonight.
Got a little surprise for you. I've got a few clips that we're going to play, and we're going to do a quiz. You know everything about The Twilight Zone, but I'm going to see if you can quickly grab the titles after we play these clips.
Okay.
We're going to test you on that. How have you been?
I'm good. And life is exciting, and I'm working on a lot of fun stuff. So things are really great.
Why the craze with Twilight Zone through all generations?
Well, I think it's that when you do something superlatively well, it lasts, you know. And I'm doing commentaries for the Blu-ray set now, as you know, and I was with Earl Hamner today, who wrote 8 great episodes. Here we are sitting 50 years, you know, almost 50 years after he wrote these. And, you know, George Clayton Johnson, all these wonderful writers. And these things, when you watch them over again, they really stand up. They're just terrific.
You know, in the message, you're absolutely right about they stand up, because the message that Rod Serling passed on to all of us holds up no matter what age you're in, no matter what decade you might be.
That's right. Well, yesterday when I was doing the commentaries with George Clayton Johnson, I was talking about how a lot of the great Twilight Zone episodes, there's a great truth in the episode. We were just watching Kick the Can, which is one of George's great pieces of work. And again, it's that whole notion of to stay young, you have to stay youthful. It's an attitude, and you have to be connected to other people, whether you're 8 years old or 80. And then the fascinating thing was when George Clayton Johnson wrote that, he was 30 years old. Now I'm sitting next to him, he's 80 years old, and we're watching the episode and doing a commentary on it. And it's very funny, because I said to him, well, watching it now, you have a different attitude. And he said, well, when the Lord comes for me, I plan to sidestep.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to do that with Ray Bradbury and I Sing the Body Electric?
Well, we're hoping to. And of course, for me, one of the high points of recording these new commentaries was the one that you and I did.
Yeah.
And that was terrific fun.
I had fun doing that with you. Okay, I'm going to play number one. What I did is I did a little research and found some of the top Twilight Zone shows that people have been polled over the years. There's 10 of them, and I've got 4 clips over the course of this hour I will play for you, Mark.
Okay.
And we'll just have you guess them, and then next hour we'll take phone calls.
Okay.
Okay, here's the first one.
Joe? Oh, Joe, say something. Do something. Move. Joe, you insult me. I won't come here anymore. I won't make noise. I won't drive people away. Honest, Joe. Move! Oh, you, mister, please, say something. I'm sorry I took the money. I don't care about the money. All I want is to hear people say something again and to see people moving again. Oh, doesn't anybody know how to make this thing work again? Someone, help! Help me! Please, somebody move!
What is it, Mark?
That's an episode called A Kind of a Stopwatch. And Rod Serling wrote it. It stars Richard Erdman. And it's about a character who gets a stopwatch that can stop time. But then, of course, he falls afoul of his own plan. So it's a very memorable episode. And absolutely.
It is one of the classics.
Yes.
One of the classics. I remember as a kid watching it. And as I was looking at the clip today when we were getting that excerpt, it was just, you know, you wanted that stopwatch to start working again.
Yes.
you really felt for the guy. And then on the other hand, you said, well, you're the darn guy who stopped everybody.
Yes, exactly. And you know, a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes are about wish fulfillment, or be careful what you wish for, because it can come back and bite you.
One thing I noticed looking at the Twilight Zone episodes, Serling or the writers came up with an incredible title for each episode.
Yes, Yeah, it's true.
Who would think of a kind of a stopwatch?
I know. I mean, Sterling really had the knack. And then of course, with Richard Matheson or Charles Beaumont or George Clayton Johnson, they would, you know, they had, again, the titles would be extremely evocative, The Howling Man, Eye of the Beholder, you know, again and again. You know, there's so many terrific titles, and you're just beguiled. You know, you hear the title and you say, well, I've got to see that one, and then you can't stop watching them.
It was hilarious because in a kind of a stopwatch, he said he went to a Mets game. And his favorite team and player, he was running to second base, and it was obvious he was going to get thrown out. So he stopped the watch, and he moved second base.
Yes.
just amazing.
And you start to think, well, what would I do if I had a stopwatch that did that, or if I had a camera that could take pictures of the future, et cetera? You start thinking about, well, would I do as badly as some of the characters, or would I do better? And even with something like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, when William Shatner sees the gremlin on the wing of the airplane, it's like, well, would I be brave enough to take the actions that he takes to save everyone? So these are always challenges to rise to your best self or be tempted in ways you shouldn't be tempted.
I would stop traffic in L.A. with my stopwatch, go up the side of the ramp, and pass them all up.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way to do it.
I think so.
One of my favorites. Okay, here's another one. I know I'm not going to be able to stump you,
but
it's going to be fun trying anyway.
Remember now, coming back to you? That's odd. It's really odd, but suddenly I seem to remember. Coming back now, is it? I'm a mannequin. That's what I am. I'm a mannequin. And it was my turn.
Your turn to leave us for a month. Becoming much clearer now, isn't it? You left us for a month and you lived with the outsiders. But you were due back yesterday and you didn't show up.
What is it, Mark?
That's The After Hours, and it stars Anne Francis. It was directed by my dear friend Douglas Hayes, and it's again a terrific episode. I just did a commentary on it recently, and it's just one of my favorites. In fact, today I was doing the other Anne Francis episode, Jess Bell, an hour-long episode that Earl Hamner wrote, and Anne Francis is one of my favorite actresses, and just unforgettable.
The mannequin. Because what was so cool is as she was walking around, looking at the people who were really mannequins.
Yes.
You know, it was starting to come back to her that that's what she was.
Yes, exactly. And what I mean, just what an incredible story. That was one of Rod Serling's scripts, and it's unforgettable because you think, well, what if I were trapped in that department store being menaced by those mannequins? And the irony about that episode was that that MGM had just shot a feature film and they built a huge set for a newspaper office, and so Twilight Zone was able to redress it as a department store. So you have this enormous set that you would normally never get for a half-hour TV show, and Doug Hayes certainly knew how to use that space brilliantly.
What got the fondness of the Twilight Zone in your blood, Mark?
Wow, you know, it's, I just grew up watching it, and it was just, sort of like the common mythology between me and all the other kids at school, and it just got under my skin, and that one, and Outer Limits, and Star Trek, those were the shows that made me want to become a writer, and to sit with the writers who did these shows, and the directors, and the actors, and the funny thing is, with the Blu-ray commentaries, you know, I was brought aboard to do, they're utilizing a lot of the original interviews that I did back when I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, so I've got 100 hours of those with the directors and the writers and so forth. But also, I had the idea of talking to people who were inspired by The Twilight Zone to create a new generation of work. So I'm going to, you know, Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, and friends of mine who, you know, wrote movies like Iron Man and so forth, and having them do commentaries with me. And it's just so much fun to find out what inspired them and how Twilight Zone really showed them the possibility of what you could do in film and TV.
You've got to tell us the story of how you were rummaging through Rod Serling's attic.
Yes. Well, fortunately, when I got out of college, I knew I wanted to be a writer-producer working in television, and there were no classes in that. And so I thought, well, let's study, you know, one of the greatest shows ever made and see how it was done so I could learn how to do it. And so I started working on The Twilight Zone Companion when I was 22 years old, and it was only 2 years after Rod Serling's untimely death. He died at only 50 years old. But his house and everything was still exactly as he'd left it. Carol Sterling, his widow, was living there with his dog. And so I would literally crawl through Rod's attic as I was researching the book. His scrapbooks were up there, his files. I opened one box that was unmarked, and it was filled with Twilight Zone scripts that he and Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont and Ray Bradbury had written that were not filmed. They were unfilmed Twilight Zone scripts, and so this was just a treasure trove.
I love it. I love it. Stay with us, Mark. We're going to take phone calls next hour with you, and the calls don't have to be just about Twilight Zone. Mark is an expert on sci-fi shows extraordinaire. His website, Zicree.com, Z-I-C-R-E-E.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment with Mark Zicree on Coast to Coast AM. But on Saturday, it's none other than Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. Ian, how are you?
I'm enjoying the Olympics. Have you been following them?
No. You know what? I've been so busy doing this and some other things, I really haven't.
Yeah, Mr. Convention. I heard about that. Did you have a good time?
I did. I did. Yeah. It was a great. You know, they love us. They love you.
And, well, and that new book, when's that? Are you touring on that yet?
No, I'm not going to tour on the second one. There's another one coming out shortly, and shortly could be in months. That one will be a tour.
So. Okay. Would that mean you'll be coming back up here to the Great White North? Or
yeah, absolutely. Okay. You know, I miss Minneapolis.
It'll probably still be white when you get here, too.
Well, yeah, it's about time. It used to be that way when I lived there.
Yeah, it's we've had a lot of snow, although it's been warm lately. 60 degrees in Vancouver. You got to love that.
Oh, my gosh.
So tomorrow night, we've had a little change of schedule. Walter Koenig, who, Koenig, as some people say, the guy who played Chekhov on Star Trek, was originally scheduled to be on, but a family emergency that we understood was quite surprising and scary has called him away. So he will not be joining us in the first hour tomorrow night, but we look forward to getting Chekhov again on the air sometime
good.
Soon. Still, we'll hear the story of an absolutely flawless diamond heist. Do you like heist movies?
I love heist movies.
We're going to love this story. It's all of the details for the first time. You will feel like you have pulled off the greatest diamond heist of all time. It was pulled off just a few years ago, record number of diamonds and amount, and without a single shot fired. And we'll talk about how the things they did right and the things they did wrong. Just in case you ever plan on stealing $500 million in diamonds in Antwerp sometime soon, you can take notes coming up tomorrow night.
Okay? Hey, by the way, I looked on the calendar. I know we're months ahead. Uh-huh. Christmas is on a Saturday.
I know.
You're working?
I'm looking forward to that. I know that's a George Norrie tradition. Would you like me to step aside so you can maintain your unbroken streak?
I'm gonna do Friday night Christmas Eve live.
Right.
So I'll do that. If you're not gonna be there Christmas night, I'll be there. So
well,
it's up to you.
I look forward to doing it. The one night I couldn't do is Christmas Eve. That's when I'll be all collared up.
And I'll be doing that.
So I'm glad to share that weekend with you, and I look forward to it.
We'll have some fun. Thanks.
Talk to you soon. All right, bye.
And we'll be back in a moment with Mark Zicree as we talk more about the Twilight Zone on Coast to Coast AM. Now, the term Twilight Zone, of course, simply means a gray area. And, Mark, it was Rod Serling himself who chose the title.
That's right, exactly. And in fact, originally he was going to call the show Odd Street. That was reported. And that certainly would not have been as melodious a title as Twilight Zone. But the funny thing to think about is that there was really no term for that notion before Rod coined Twilight Zone. Now you can say, well, I just felt like I was in the Twilight Zone, or, you know, someone rear-ended me, and it was like I was in the Twilight Zone. But before then, there was really no way of describing that except going into, you know, long paragraphs. And so Rod really did everyone a great service.
When you were doing your research into the Twilight Zone companion, did you stumble across anything, or what made Rod come up with this series? Because, you know, was he always this way, strange?
Well, the funny thing was he never intended to become a science fiction writer. That was not at all his career trajectory. He grew up as a kid reading science fiction and certainly loving it. He read the pulp magazines, you know, Amazing and Astounding and so forth, he and his brother Bob. But when he got into television, he was a mainstream dramatist. He sort of wanted to be the Arthur Miller of television. He and Patty Chayefsky and Reginald Rose, they were writing really heavyweight kind of dramas. Literally, Rod wrote something called Requiem for a Heavyweight that was about the world of fighters, and he wrote Patterns, which was the world of executives, business. But whenever he tried to write about politics or racial issues or social issues, he was heavily censored by the network and the sponsors. And so finally, he could, in fact, he even wrote something about politics where he couldn't even use the terms Democrat or Republican. And so finally, he said, you know, if I had set this thing in the future and put robots in the Senate, I could have gotten my point across. And that sort of gave him the germ of the idea. So even though he was the best paid and most lauded a dramatist working in TV. In 1958, he sat down and wrote his first pilot for The Twilight Zone, the first script. It was something called Time Element, and ironically, that got shelved and finally was made as a Desilu Playhouse, and that got enough of an audience and a male response that CBS then let him write another pilot, and eventually that got shot and became The Twilight Zone. But interestingly enough, The Time Element, which has never been included in the syndication package on Twilight Zone, will actually be in the Blu-ray set. We're including that in the set, so it'll be great to see it again.
Do you think he pitched CBS the way people are pitching networks now, where you sit down with them, you have a meeting, and you try to see if they're interested?
Yeah, he did, and he was terrific at pitching in the room. He was very enthusiastic, very articulate, incredibly winning personality. You just liked him when you met him, and he was very good doing that. And because he would get them enthusiastic, but by that time he was already under contract to CBS. He was writing Playhouse 90, which was their flagship, their most prestigious show. And so I think that when he said, basically at that point, he said, well, I've got an idea for a show. And they said, well, write a script, let us see what you're talking about. And that's what he did. Interestingly enough, he wrote three pilot scripts for Twilight Zone before he finally wrote the fourth pilot script, and that's the one that got shot and sold the series. But the first three were hour-long scripts, and then the final one was a half hour, and that set the template for the half-hour shows for the first three seasons of Twilight Zone.
Okay, here's another clip, one of the top 10. Here we go.
Her name, X-20. Her type, an experimental interceptor. Recent history, a crash landing in the Mojave Desert after a 31-hour flight 900 miles into space. Incidental data, the ship with the men who flew her disappeared from the radar screen for 24 hours.
All right, what's cool. That?
Is that And When the Sky Was Open?
That's it.
Cool. You got me nervous, George.
Almost had you.
But that's a great episode. That, again, is directed by Douglas Hayes. It's a script by Serling based on a short story by Richard Matheson called Disappearing Act. And the interesting thing about that one is that the short story by Matheson is totally different. It's just the notion that someone's disappearing and people are forgetting that they ever existed. But this is a great episode that stars Rod Taylor, who's also in The Time Machine and The Birds, a wonderful actor. And it's just a terrifically creepy episode. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful piece of work.
It even had a young Timothy Hutton.
That's right.
In this one.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know what I found fascinating at this episode, nowadays, when you look back and see these early astronauts, these stories about astronauts, and this was before we even went to the moon, it had an aura about it, Mark. It was kind of eerie. I mean, these were guys that would go into space. What's going to happen to them?
That's right.
It was
That's
fascinating.
Right. Well, this is because we hadn't sent men in the space yet, and there was the possibility of anything happening, and so Twilight Zone definitely explored that possibility. So it was, and Twilight Zone was. It's funny because it wasn't just science fiction shows, but it was also horror. It was fantasy. It could cover a wide range of stories, and it was also very much about everyday kind of people who would just turn a corner and something incredible and unusual would happen.
Did Rod ever do radio before he did television?
He did indeed. His first sale was to, he wrote for Grand Central Station. He wrote for Dr. Christian. He wrote for a lot of radio shows before television. And this is late 40s, early 50s, And then segued into TV.
Okay, here's our last clip for you.
All right, Miss Tyler, I'm going to remove the last of the bandages now. Would you like a mirror?
No. No, thank you. No mirror.
All right, then. I want you to remember this, please. Miss Tyler, are you listening?
Yes, I'm listening.
Now, we have done all we could do. If we've been successful, well and good, there are no problems. But if, on the other hand, this final treatment has not achieved the desired result, please remember, Miss Tyler, that you can still live a long and fruitful life among people of your own kind. Now, as soon as we discover the results, we'll either release you or...
Doctor?
Yes?
If I'm still terribly ugly, well, is there any other alternative? Could I please be put away?
Wow.
Ugly. They took the bandages off. She looked pretty good to me.
That's right. That's Eye of the Beholder, of course. And that's another terrific script by Rod Serling. It's got marvelous direction, by Douglas Hayes. Three of these four episodes were by Doug Hayes as a director. And the fasting tidbit about that episode is it has a woman whose head is wrapped in bandages. She's supposedly hideously ugly, and then when her face is revealed, she's quite the opposite. And it, two actresses play that role. So when it was the actress under bandages was Maxine Stewart, who, as you can hear, had this wonderfully expressive voice. And then when it's revealed what she looks like, it's Donna Douglas, who later would play Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies.
And we can't give away the total ending.
No.
But another classic.
Yes, a terrific episode. Once you've seen it, you never, never, never forget it.
It had the punch and then the message.
Yeah.
It was bang, bang.
Yeah, and again, this speaks to why you can watch these episodes again and again, because they're about people. They're about the human heart and about compassion and about all the issues that we live with day to day, about love and life and death. Big issues told in a very very visceral way. So even when you know what the reveal is or the gimmick is, you're still drawn in by the characters and by the reality at the heart of these episodes.
These 10, Mark, in not any particular order. Another one was A World of Difference. Do you remember this one?
Sure, of course. And that's one by Richard Matheson, and that stars Howard Duff. And again, it's about a man who he thinks he's a lawyer, but then everyone else tells him that he's an actor playing a lawyer. And the question is, what's reality and what's fantasy? And again, the nature of identity was something that Twilight Zone would exploit again and again and again. There's another great episode called Mirror Image, where a woman goes into a bus stop and starts seeing a bus station, and she starts seeing a duplicate of herself who's basically coming from a parallel dimension and trying to take over her life. And again, there's that issue of, Rod talked about the greatest fear of all was the fear of the unknown working on you, which you cannot share with others. And you see that again and again and again in Twilight Zone.
Did he want to scare people?
I think he wanted to make people think. More than anything else, Rod was very concerned about the world and about issues such as racism and war. And he wanted people, I think if you could have said to Rod, what would you like more than anything? I think he would have said, I'd like people to treat each other better. I'd like them to be more compassionate. And I think the Twilight Zone often has a compassionate viewpoint. Not always. Every now and then Rod would come across a story like, you know, To Serve Man or It's a Good Life, one of those where it's got such a snapper that he's just, okay, let's just go for the powerful punch. But basically, I think he was someone who really wanted a better world, and I think he was using Twilight Zone to advocate that.
One of the other top 10, Night Call.
Yeah, that's
classic with Elva Keen.
That's right. That's Gladys Cooper. It was directed by Jacques Tourneur, who was the great director of Cat People and Curse of the Demon, wonderful horror films. And we just did the commentary on that with my friend Michael Nankin, who is a director on Battlestar Galactica and Heroes and CSI, wonderful director and a writer as well, dear friend of mine. And it was great fun to sit down with him and take that episode apart. It's a wonderful episode.
Will the real Martian please stand up?
Yes. That's one of the great comic episodes. It stars John Hoyt, who I interviewed when I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion. And it's about a group of people in the diner, and one of them is a Martian in disguise, and it's just so much fun to guess who the Martian is.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
It's a classic. The Midnight Sun.
Yes, that's a great episode with Lois Nettleton, where throughout the majority of the episode we believe that the Earth is moving closer to the sun and it's going to burn up and everyone's dying of heat prostration. And it was directed by Tony Leader, and who also did along with Walter Jameson. And you just feel the heat. And in fact, for certain scenes, they turned up the heat on the set, so the actors were really feeling it. It was
brilliant.
They didn't have to use their imaginations.
I had the opportunity several times now of interviewing William Shatner,
yeah.
And of course he was in Nick of Time.
That's right.
One of them.
That's right. And the other great episode is Nightmare at 20,000 Feet,
yeah.
which we just mentioned a moment ago. And that was William Shatner before Star Trek, and he is at the peak of his powers and just an amazingly intense actor.
The other one was called Ring-a-Ding Girl, and I don't remember that one.
That's a lesser-known episode. It's written by Earl Hamner, who went on to create The Waltons and Falcon Crest. And I was just doing commentaries with Earl Hamner today on some of his other Twilight Zone episodes. He did The Hunt. He did The Bewitching Pool. He did Jess Bell. Ring-a-Ding Girl is a fifth-season episode. That's the final season of The Twilight Zone. It's about a movie star who goes back to her hometown, and she can see different scenes in this ring that she wears. It's one of the lesser-known episodes, but definitely entertaining.
My favorites didn't make this list. To Serve Man, that was the classic Talkie Tina, the one you know about, because That's the one you interviewed me for.
Yes, which was so much fun.
And what was the name of the one with Agnes Moorehead?
The Invaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What an ending on that one.
Oh, my God, yes. And Agnes Moorehead was one of the great actresses. She played Endora on Bewitched, but she also played, you know, Kane's mother in Citizen Kane. And Douglas Hayes, again, that was one of his signature episodes. And she's this farm woman who's menaced by these two strange little invaders from outer space. And, again, we won't reveal the ending, but it's definitely a great twist.
Now, in what you're doing now is you've got a group of people that are taking these old Twilight Zones and you're cleaning them up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Blu-ray is this new.
Oh, that's the hot one. Yep.
That's the DVD format, the HD format. And what basically we already did a great definitive set for the DVD release, but when they came to me and said, well, you know, we're going to be releasing it on Blu-ray and there's much more capacity. We can put much more stuff on it on this set. I said, okay, well, here's what we'll do. In addition to having a lot of the audio commentaries and the audio tape that I did back when I did Twilight Zone Companion, the archival stuff, we'll do 50 episodes where I'll do commentaries with some great people. So Neil Gaiman, who wrote Coraline, and Mark Ferguson, who co-wrote Iron Man and Children of Men, and my friend David Simpkins, who writes and produces Warehouse 13, and Len Wein, who created Wolverine and Human Target, and you know my friend Rocky O'Bannon, who created Farscape.
Yeah.
It was just on and on. And then, of course, I thought of you, certainly. And a few days ago, we did George Takei. And George Takei, it's a really interesting subject because when I started working on the Twilight Zone Companion, there were a handful, a small number of episodes that weren't in syndication, weren't available on video. And for 40 years, there was an episode of the Twilight Zone starring George Takei, who later would play Sulu on Star Trek, and it had not been seen for 40 years. And now it's available on DVD and soon will be on the Blu-ray edition. So I sat down with George Takei and the director of that episode, Robert Butler, last week, and we watched that episode. We talked about it, and that was quite a treat.
Super. Now, do you remember Leave It to Beaver?
Of course.
Okay, June Cleaver, played by Barbara Billingsley.
Yes.
She apparently used to play poker with Rod Serling's families before his death.
Wow. That's
small world, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, well, Rod was just this amazingly gregarious, warm-hearted guy. He would tell jokes. He loved people. Frequently, people would tell me that when they met Rod, he was more interested in hearing their stories than being the center of attention. He really loved hearing people's histories and what they thought and what they felt.
That's why he was a genius, because he picked up on those stories, and I bet he turned some of them into Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh, I'm sure he did, absolutely. And you can't write those kind of characters. I mean, the thing that's so great about Twilight Zone is there's so many of the characters are, you know, bank tellers, sales girls, you know, small people, little people that often, you know, you would tend to ignore or pass by, and but not Rod. He paid attention to them, and that's, I think, what makes Twilight Zone so strong. Another episode that we just did the commentary on was Night of the Meek, where Art Carney plays a drunken department store Santa who gets to become Santa, and it was just so wonderful to watch that episode. And again, he really understands the heart of someone who's suffering and someone who wants to have a larger, better life and a life of kindness for others. So it was wonderful to revisit that episode.
He had a lot of people who are big names today.
Yes.
Were they big names then that he had? I mean, when Burgess Meredith did them, I would assume he had a big name then, didn't he?
At that point, Burgess Meredith was very well known. He'd already starred in Of Mice and Men and a lot of things. But yesterday, when I did the commentary on Nothing in the Dark with George Clayton Johnson, who wrote that episode, Robert Redford stars in that episode with Gladys Cooper. And I said to George, well, you know, was this what was Redford's career like at this point? He said, well, you know, Redford hadn't yet made it. And in fact, George got to know Redford, and Robert Redford said, you know, he would go to auditions, and he was always auditioning with another actor that was thought of as very similar to him, which was George Peppard. They were struggling young actors at that point, and Nothing in the Dark really was the sort of a breakthrough role for Redford. All of a sudden, he had this amazing role where he played Mr. Death, and he got to be, it was basically a two-character piece where he's, you know, a half hour of major network screen time just with another actress, with Gladys Cooper, and it just put him out front, and then from then on he rose and very quickly became a movie star. So these could really be career-making roles.
If we had a chance to interview Redford now, if we can get him on this program and asked him specifically, did Rod Serling change your career, boost it? I bet he'd say yes.
I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would. And because, again, you know, when you get a script that really lets you show what you can do, and this is also where Rod Serling would let the other writers do that too, because they were so used to being rewritten on other shows. And Rod said to these writers like Matheson, Charles Beaumont, and George Clayton Johnson and Earl Hammer, he said, write the script you want to write and we will shoot the script that you write. And they were dubious at first. Charles Beaumont thought, well, nah, good luck. And then he saw that they meant it. And so Rod had great respect for other writers, and the written word was really king on Twilight Zone. And so when an actor gets a script like that, they rise to the occasion. They just give it their all.
Whereabouts did he live in Hollywood,
Mark? Rod lived in Pacific Palisades, which is a very sort of upscale neighborhood. It's on the west side of town, sort of a little north, heading up toward the coast, toward Malibu. And he lived in a very large, beautiful house with an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And it had a separate little building back of the house that was his office. But in the mornings, he'd wake up. He'd lounge by the swimming pool, and he would dictate his scripts into a tape recorder, and then his secretary would type them up, and he'd make little hand corrections. And then by about noon, he'd be sort of written out, so he'd drive down to MGM, where the Twilight Zone was shot in Culver City, and then he'd do his producer job for the rest of the day.
That's great.
Yeah, it was a pretty nice life.
Let's take phone calls with you when we come back. Mark Zachary, Twilight Zone questions, science fiction questions. You've got Mark Zachary, the real deal, right here on Coast to Coast AM.